Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to November's edition of Chemistry World with Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and James Mitchell-Crowe. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, how researchers have shed some light on the ageing process and how we can stop it. The one downside is that the process seems to take a lifetime.
It was a disappointingly long time, I thought. They did this therapy over a period of about a year, and it was a sort of a therapeutic session of about 30 minutes a day. And it's a particular device that's been created. It's a medical light therapy device with a quite cool name. It's called Warp 10. But yeah, it's not just a case of sort of shine the LED from your TV remote control at your face and see the results within a week. It does seem to take quite a long time.
Victoria Gill ironing out the wrinkles in that aging story. That's coming up very shortly. Also, this year's Chemistry Nobel laureate, Martin Chalfy, reveals how he came up with the idea of putting a jellyfish gene into a worm.
Well, I actually don't remember anything that I heard in the seminar after having this idea. I was so excited. I spent the rest of the day trying to find out who was working on green fluorescent protein and how far they had gotten. And I soon found that Douglas Prescher was the person that was trying to clone the gene.
Martin Chalfy, and also on the way, how scientists have reincarnated a famous experiment from the 1950s that showed how the early Earth could have spawned the building blocks of life.
Stanley once reached up and got this cardboard box down from his bookshelf and said, "Hey, look, I got some vials in here from my original experiment." And I also realized that that stuff was in my lab. So I came back to my office and lab, and we sat down and found these boxes. We opened them up, and lo and behold, here were all these vials from the 53-54 experiments he conducted.
Jeff Bader, who found the remains of Stanley Miller's original experiments sitting on a shelf in his lab. He'll be telling us what he found when he reanalyzed those materials. Also on the way, of course, is the answer to last month's chemical conundrum.
It's 50 years since this scientist, the only scientist ever to have won two chemistry Nobel Prizes, won his first Nobel. What is his name and which protein would you associate him with?
So if you sent in a scientific suggestion, then you could be one of this month's winners. The answer's on the way.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, James, it sounds like scientists have come a step closer to creating a Spider-Man suit.
Yes, that's right, Chris. You might be able to stick to walls yourself one day. This team of scientists in America have made a material that mimics the surface of geckos' feet and so can stick very heavy objects to walls and then can detach as well.
Well, first of all, tell us, James, how do geckos do it?
The trick that geckos have is that they've got a surface of very fine hairs on the pads of their feet, and that gives a very high surface area, so it gives you strong van der Waals interactions between their toes and the wall. So if you can make a surface that has a similar sort of coating of very fine hairs, then you could potentially use the same trick.
And so is that what these guys have done?
Yeah, they've made a surface that is coated with carbon nanotubes, which when not attached to a wall, it's quite a messy sort of jumbled up surface. But when you attach it to the wall and then put some sort of force on it, it pulls all those nanotubes straight and aligns them. And that's what gives you the really high surface area that sticks the stuff to the wall. And so they say that...
I was just going to say, on that note, when you plaster it on the wall, does that mean then that it's easy to pull off in any direction, or does it have the same amount of attraction in any direction that you apply the force to it?
Well, it's dependent on hanging a force on it. So as soon as you remove the force, then the fibres sort of tangle up again. And so then you can just pull the stuff off very quickly.
Which makes it very useful, because if you can obviously hang a great weight on it but very easily lift it off, it's a bit like a post-it note, I suppose, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yes. 3 centimetre squares of this material can hold 150 kilo.
Is it easy to make? How will we use it?
They say that it is pretty straightforward to make. Carbon nanotubes get easier to make all the time, and they suggest that it might be used for things like the pads of feet of robots, for example, that they might be able to climb walls.
I did also hear one suggestion that things like this could be useful in space, because astronauts can then put it on the bottoms of their boots and go walking around on the outside of their spacecraft in order to stick them on.
Yeah, there are many applications that you could think of where being able to attach and detach from a surface with really high strength would be amazing.
Thanks, James. Well, from wrinkly feet on geckos to wrinkles on your face. And this is very interesting, Vic. You might have a way, or you might be able to shed some light on how we can deal with the problem.
Indeed. This work comes out of the University of Ulm, and this is a group led by André Sommer, who actually looks at the structures of water and its sort of interactions with surfaces. And it's kind of a side study in some of his latest work that he's discovered that light in the form of a penetrating LED light source that's actually used for pain relief and has been used for quite a long time can reduce the wrinkles in your skin.
What sort of light does the LED pump out?
It's visible light. It's the same wavelength as visible light. And what they've found is that those wavelengths of light can penetrate the skin. And it's been used therapeutically, light therapy, for a long time, for many decades. But they've found a sort of a physical interaction with water molecules in your skin that has a visible effect.
And tell us a bit more. How does that actually work? What do we think it's actually doing to the skin?
So this is all to do with elastin, which, as its name suggests, is an elastic protein, long fibres of stretchy protein that give skin its elasticity. And young skin can sort of stretch back and reform quite well without forming wrinkles. When you smile, you don't get the crow's feet surrounding your eyes or the smile lines around your mouth.
Well, at least not straight away.
At least not straight away. But as these proteins age, they have a sort of crystal layer of water around them because the actual protein fibres are hydrophobic, they're water-hating. So they keep the water on the outside in these sort of interfacial layers, they call them. But as the elastin breaks down as you age, this water gets sort of in amongst the fibres and it forms a viscous layer that stops the fibres from being able to stretch and reform and do their job. So what they think the light source is doing is actually physically interacting with these water molecules that are forming this viscous layer. They're stripping the water molecules away so that elastin can sort of be freed up to become stretchy and bounce back again.
So how much therapy do you need? Am I going to have to sleep under this thing to preserve my beauty forever? Or do you need just a few minutes a day?
It was a disappointingly long time, I thought. They did this therapy over a period of about a year and it was a sort of a therapeutic session of about 30 minutes a day. And it's a particular device that's been created. It's a medical light therapy device with a quite cool name. It's called Warp 10. But yeah, it's not just a case of sort of shine the LED from your TV remote control at your face and see the results within a week. It does seem to take quite a long time.
Any negative effects?
No, it doesn't seem to appear so, no. They've just seen this very happy sort of side effect that if they use this on facial skin and crow's feet, they seem to very gradually, I should put it, disappear.
So a little light relief from the effects of the ageing process. Thank you, Victoria. And now on the subject of light, to an illuminating story that led this man to win this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He's Martin Chalfy, and his breakthrough was to take a glowing green gene from a jellyfish and add it to a worm.
Okay, well, the story starts with another of the Nobel laureates, Osamu Shimomura. It was his fascination with bioluminescence that led him to try to understand how the jellyfish produced light. And he isolated a protein called a quorin. Now, a quorin is the light-producing molecule from the jellyfish, but the light that it produces is a blue light. And he knew that the jellyfish didn't produce blue light, they produced a green light. So it meant to him immediately that there must be something else that is converting the energy from quorin into green light. And he found that there was this other protein that he originally called the green protein, now we call it green fluorescent protein, that actually took the energy from a quorin and converted it into green light. My involvement occurred many years after he had made this discovery. I was listening to a seminar, and as part of the introduction to the seminar, Paul Brehm mentioned that in addition to a quorin, there was this rather unusual protein called the green fluorescent protein, and he described some of its properties. Well, for the 12 years or so before that seminar, I had been working on the nematode Cenorhabditis elegans, and the animal was transparent. Since we were at the time doing some gene expression studies, it immediately occurred to me that it would be a wonderful thing if we could possibly have, as a marker for gene expression, a fluorescent protein.
But as you hadn't worked on the protein before then, how did you actually go about trying to get hold of it and therefore begin to understand how it worked and how you might be able to apply it to the C. elegans, the worm work?
Well, I actually don't remember anything that I heard in the seminar after having this idea. I was so excited. I spent the rest of the day trying to find out who was working on green fluorescent protein and how far they had gotten. And I soon found that Douglas Prescher was the person that was trying to clone the gene. He had previously already cloned the gene for a quorin. We had a wonderful conversation, and we arranged that we would do a collaboration. The next important step in this story is that I got married, but my wife at the time was at a university, was about 2,000 miles away from where I am here in New York, and so I took a sabbatical in her lab. It was just during the time that I was in her lab that Douglas Prescher cloned the gene, and he couldn't contact me. I was no longer here at Columbia, and then when he tried to call at the University of Utah, the people there hadn't learned who I was, and so they said, oh, no, he's not here. Douglas interpreted this as meaning that I had dropped out of science. About 3 years later, I had a student starting in my lab, Gia Skirkin, and when we were talking, I said, well, I'll tell you a wonderful project I'd like to do, but I've never been contacted by the person who's cloning the gene. So we look it up, we look up green fluorescent protein, and the first paper that comes up is Douglas Prescher's paper about the cloning of what at the time was called APOGFP. We called him up, and we arranged to continue the collaboration we had talked about several years before, and he sent us the cDNA for green fluorescent protein.
So then did you get the PhD student in question to begin to clone the gene, say, into bacteria, for example?
Yes, the first experiment was to put the gene and try to express it into E. coli, which Gia did. And in fact, within 1 month of getting the clone, we had green fluorescent bacteria, and we knew that this would work. And then when we subsequently put it into worms, and it was also fluorescent, we knew that it could be a marker really anywhere.
And once you got it into the worm, of course, then the floodgates are open because you can begin to use the fact that it's a tiny, well-understood model system, transparent, with glowing cells now, which you can follow, understand their fates, and work out what different cell lineages do.
We can do many things with this. So an example from my own lab, we're interested in the sense of touch. There are only 6 touch-sensing cells in the animal. We can express GFP only in those cells, and those are the only cells that have the bright fluorescence in them. We can then take those animals and look for mutants, variants that are unusual in the growth of the nerve cells. Either the nerve cells are not there, there's no GFP positive cells, or the nerve cells send out processes that grow in the wrong direction, or maybe they have abnormal branching patterns. And we can look for these defects in nerve development simply by looking at the animal and seeing how the cells are different from the wild type or normal animal.
Columbia University's Martin Chalfy, one of the winners of the 2008 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. And if you're wondering what happened to Doug Prescher, the man who cloned the GFP gene in the first place and then collaborated with Martin in the early days, well, because he was unable to secure further funding for his work, Martin tells me that he now drives a bus. How's that for scientific justice? This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, better biofuels. Scientists have found a more effective way to liberate the beneficial chemicals in wood. And also Brian Cox joins us to explain what exactly has gone wrong with the LHC. But first, to a story that began in the 1950s with a paper published in the journal Science by California-based researcher Stanley Miller. He showed that the conditions on the early Earth could naturally have produced some of the building blocks of life. And now, 50 years later, one of his former co-workers has found the original material that was produced in those experiments and subjected it to modern-day chemical analysis. Here's Jeff Bader.
Well, in 1953, Stanley Miller published a short paper in Science describing how you could synthesize amino acids, which are a component of all living organisms today, in a model primitive Earth experiment. And what he did is he took methane, ammonia, hydrogen, applied an electric spark to it, sort of to simulate lightning in the early atmosphere. And in that, he produced, like I said, amino acids, which was a great breakthrough because all of a sudden we had evidence that you could create the raw materials thought to be necessary for the origin of life in a simulated prebiotic Earth environment. Unfortunately, going from amino acids to more complex molecules has proven to be a bigger challenge than making the simple molecules themselves, but we are making progress in that area.
What was your kind of role in the present paper that you've just published in Science?
Well, I was Stanley's second graduate student, so I've been immersed in this whole field of prebiotic chemistry and the origin of life my whole career. And just by chance, another dear friend of Stanley's, Antonio Lascano, and I were in Texas to give a series of back-to-back lectures. And Antonio says, oh, by the way, you know, Stanley once reached up and got this cardboard box down from his bookshelf and said, hey, look, I got some vials in here from my original experiment. And I also realized that that stuff was in my lab. So I came back to my office and lab, and we sat down and found these boxes. We opened them up, and lo and behold, here were all these other little boxes inside with vials clearly labeled, indicating that they came from the 53-54 experiments he conducted.
And he'd actually kept those pristine, so you can be reasonably confident that the material in there was the material that he synthesized in those experiments.
Absolutely, because they were very meticulously collected and stored and labeled. And it turned out that his laboratory notebooks were present in the archive at the UCSD library. And so we went up and looked at his notebooks and were able to assign each of these various boxes of vials to a specific experiment that he'd conducted in 53-54. I was particularly interested in one experiment that he'd conducted using a different apparatus. It had an aspirator on the flask where the water was boiled. And what this did is it produced a jet of hot steam directly into the spark chamber. And I was intrigued by the possibility of how this might mimic a steam-rich volcanic eruption, particularly since we now know that volcanic eruptions are accompanied by very intense lightning. The surmise here was that you could have a volcanic system that was belching reduced gases, and these were immediately subjected to lightning. This would have resulted in the local synthesis of amino acids rather than a global synthesis that Stanley had imagined.
So how did you then go about analyzing the vestiges of what was in those flasks to see whether or not it agreed with what he'd published and if there was anything else lurking in there?
The first thing we did is we carefully suspended the residues in water and took a very tiny aliquot of that. With today's modern analytical techniques, we have sensitivities that are many millions of times better than what he had available. The first thing we did is look at it and see, okay, is there anything here? And do the compounds that we see that he identified look to be in the same proportions? And sure enough, he had identified 5 amino acids in each of the experiments with a different apparatus. But more intriguing was that the compounds that we could detect that he didn't have the capability of detecting were much more diverse than we could have imagined.
So how much more was lurking in there than Stanley Miller thought?
Well, he identified 5 amino acids, and we've now identified over 22. In the Science paper, we stopped at C6 amino acids. I would safely guess that the actual number of compounds that are present in there could be approaching up to 50 or so.
So this sounds like an amazing breakthrough, really, because it adds a lot of credence to this early model that the early Earth was actually spawning all kinds of interesting soups, which could quite well have produced some quite exciting chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. And I hear today the comment that most geoscientists think the atmosphere wasn't reducing. It did not have methane and ammonia and hydrogen, and thus the Miller experiment is irrelevant. And I take exception to that, because what I think is happening is you could have had all these little hotspot volcanic island-type systems on the early Earth, and they could have been locally synthesizing amino acids that could have been then part of the global prebiotic soup. And so instead of having a sort of a global synthesis, you had all these little tiny chemical factories sitting on the surface of the Earth producing the ingredients necessary for the original life.
Amazing to think that that box containing all that material has been sitting in a lab for over 50 years. That was Jeff Bader from the University of California, San Diego, reanalyzing Stanley Miller's original work on the origins of the building blocks of life. We're now to some more modern experimentation, and this time into biofuels. because scientists are saying that you need to treat your wood gently, James.
Yes, that's right. You should be good to it because it could be potentially a source of fuel, thanks to some new research done by Ferdi Schutt and colleagues at Max Planck in Germany. He's worked out a new, easier way to break down cellulose fibres from wood and sort of related waste plant material into short chains, which could then be fed to enzymes to be broken down into sugars like ethanol, which could be a potential fuel, so a biofuel.
Why do we need this, and why haven't we been able to do this before?
We have been able to break down cellulose before, but it takes really harsh treatment. For example, you have to use very strong acid or very high temperatures and pressures to break it down, because the sugar chains that make up the cellulose, they're sort of tangled up into microfibrils within the wood, and that sort of protects their bonds from easy chemical attack, which is why it's been a problem to break the cellulose down. The reason that we really want to do it is because cellulose is a hugely abundant stuff, and it's not a food. We can't break it down ourselves in our guts, and so it could be a potential source of fuel that wouldn't impact on food supplies. You could just use food waste or the sort of leftover agricultural waste.
And so this new technique, how does it work?
What he has done is he's taken an ionic liquid and an acid resin. It turns out that cellulose will actually dissolve in ionic liquids. You can actually put in small wood chips and they will slowly break down. So once they're dissolved, if you also add in a solid acid resin, then that acid is enough to start breaking down those long chains into smaller pieces. Once you've started to break down the chains, then that means that other techniques, for example, enzymes, can be used to break down those short chains into the sugars.
And is this actually scalable? In other words, is this practical at an industrial or even a domestic level?
Well, potentially, yes. Schutt says that he's actually in talks with BASF to look at the industrial potential of this technique. The slight downside with the technique is that to get these shorter chains out of the ionic liquid, you have to add water. They dissolve in the water and then you separate the two. But that separation takes quite a lot of energy, so that's the downside.
I was just going to say, does this actually make energetic sense? Is it worth doing this?
It's going to need a little fine-tuning, but potentially this could be a neat way.
Thanks, James. So let's hope that we can all power our cars by putting not a tiger in your tank, but perhaps an oak tree in future. Who knows? Richard, this is very interesting. A new way to detect drugs using a cantilever.
That's right, Chris. It's fascinating stuff from researchers in the UK, Australia and Kenya. And they're using arrays of tiny cantilevers, as you say, tiny micrometer-thin diving boards of silicon as sensors to detect the binding between drugs and their targets. So what's going on here is that on your diving board, you've covered it with receptors that your drug is going to attack. And when your drug comes in and binds to a receptor, it causes the board to bend. Now, this has already been known. It's already been used to detect a various number of biochemical interactions. But what the researchers do here, and they're led by Rachel McKendry at University College London, is that they can use arrays of boards and they can screen very, very rapidly, very high throughput screen for potent drugs. They can screen thousands of drugs an hour. And if you have different receptors on a different board, you would be able to screen lots and lots of variants of the same drug.
And presumably this is a way of determining how tightly the drug bonds or locks onto those receptors, so you can work out affinities and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, what this team have done, you might not think it's possible, but they've actually related the bending of the board mathematically to the affinity of the drug to the receptor, which is pretty clever, and a completely different way of working out binding interactions. What they actually did in practice is they looked at the interaction between vancomycin and antibiotic and an artificial amino acid sequence that mimics what it attacks in a bacterial cell wall. And having shown that the cantilever bends when vancomycin comes in and showing that the wrong sequence doesn't quite work, they actually came up with a new explanation or partial explanation of how vancomycin is breaking down a cell wall. What they found was that with lots of receptors covering a board, the vancomycin coming in, causing the board to bend, created kind of stress lines across the board, a kind of mechanical explanation of how the antibiotic might be punching its way through the wall. Nothing to do with the binding to the receptors or signal cascades, which are, you know, maybe going on as well, but a secondary stress-based explanation which hadn't been put forward before.
So in addition to showing us interesting insights into how antibiotics that we thought we knew about very well and thought we understood very well might be working, why else is this better than what pharmacologists and scientists can already do?
Well, it is simply a new way of detecting drugs. It's still in its infancy, so they're still working on it. Because cantilevers are already produced for atomic force microscopes and they're already produced by Intel, it's actually quite cheap. You'd think it was quite expensive, but actually they're mass-produced.
And is it hard to make these cantilevers, or are they relatively easy to make these little diving boards and then cover them in the right receptors?
Nope, they're absolutely routinely mass-produced. And in a way, this group is just jumping on the back of some research that's already been done. These things are mainly used in atomic force microscopes where they bend, and you can use that to detect force interactions with the surface. And they're simply borrowing these for the drug detection.
So quite literally diving into drug discovery. Thank you, Richard. The switch-on of the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC, was undoubtedly one of the scientific highlights of 2008. So it must have been very embarrassing to everyone concerned when, shortly afterwards, the world's most expensive science experiment actually broke down. Here's CERN scientist Brian Cox.
Well, yeah, we had this wonderfully successful day that I think everyone heard about, where we tested the machine for the first time and we circulated beams in both directions at the LHC. And that's not to be underestimated, actually, because genuinely you don't know if a machine like that is going to work until you've made particles go around it, and it's really far from simple. But we achieved that. And then the idea was to go on up until mid-autumn this year and possibly even collide some beams at a low energy, almost certainly not at the maximum energy, but at a low energy just to make sure everything was working. But then we had a short circuit in a magnet which caused a helium leak, probably not that serious. But the problem with the LHC is that if you want to do any maintenance at all, even if it's the slightest little thing, you've got to warm up a sector of the machine. It's basically divided up into eight sectors, and they operate at minus 271 degrees, so at 1.9 Kelvin. So to do any work on it, you've got to warm it up to room temperature, and that takes about 4 weeks. And then when you've fixed it, it takes about 4 weeks to cool it down again.
How much helium is actually in the machine in total?
A lot. Basically, we use liquid helium to cool the machine down, because 1.9 Kelvin is incredibly challenging, actually, especially in a machine of that size. And so what's happened at the moment is the sector's been warmed up, and it isn't yet warm, so we haven't yet opened it up to a fix. We suspect we'll have to fix a few magnets, and we're not sure how many yet, but it's a relatively routine procedure. The trouble is, when you've cooled it down again, you're into what we call the winter shutdown at CERN, which is the planned maintenance on all the other accelerators that feed the LHC and also do other physics and other science. So by the time we have fixed it, we're into the winter shutdown, and so we come back up in the spring. And actually, remarkably, every cloud has a silver lining. It looks like because we're also able now to do maintenance a little earlier than we thought, we may well start physics next year a little earlier than we'd otherwise planned. So actually, the science might begin sooner.
What will you do with that liquid helium, though? Because helium's expensive. Do you ditch it, or can you shunt it out of the bit of the magnet that's got to be shut down and store it and then put it back in later?
We do. I mean, we lost some, but not a great deal compared to the amount that we've got. So you're right. I mean, it is expensive, but it's one of those things. I mean, to be honest, you expect things like this to happen. And the remarkable thing, actually, was that we managed to get 7/8 of the machine commissioned without any incident at all. It's a big challenge. All the engineers that I've spoken to said to me, the thing that gets you on particle physics experiments like this, big accelerators, is the plumbing, right? It's not the complicated magnets or anything. It's the liquid helium plumbing. That's the thing that takes time.
What are the challenges involved, though, in doing that plumbing with something that is 1.9 Kelvin? I would think, probably, that the work involved in that is really quite tricky to handle something and control something at those kind of low temperatures.
It really is. I mean, if the LHC itself is on a gradient, it's not flat, deliberately so because of the geology underneath Geneva. And liquid helium, superfluid helium, is even less good at running uphill than other fluids. There's no resistance to flow. So it's a very, very difficult substance to deal with. But that's the price you pay for building a superconducting machine, which is, you know, to get these immensely powerful magnets, you have to have superconducting wire. and it operates at those temperatures.
Which is quite interesting to think. You don't need to be a rocket scientist, you need to be a plumber to understand how the LHC works. But when they do get it back and resurrected and kick off again in the spring, what are the first set of experiments they're going to be looking at?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to operate the machine at something near the design energy. So I think at the moment we're going to be at an energy of 5 TV per beam. Now, the energy of the beam's maximum is 7 TV. But actually, interestingly, you have to go through what we call magnet training to get the magnets up to full power so they can deal with the full power beams. And at the moment, the machine is pretty much commissioned to 5 TV. So I suspect that what will happen is we'll get collisions at 5 TV, which will allow us to further commission the detectors, and this will be in the spring. Then the first physics that you do is in a way relatively mundane, but it's not mundane because the energy is so far above the energies that we've had previously, that we can learn a lot. You look at things like the total cross-section, which is the rate at which protons collide, basically, at that energy, which is very interesting. You look at the number of electrically charged particles that are produced in the collisions and the distribution of those. You then look for things that you know about, things like Z particles, W particles, top quarks, all the things that we know. You want to see those, and you want to see they're occurring at the right rate. You want to make sure you can measure them in the detectors. So it's kind of a process of calibration and making new measurements at this energy frontier. So it's not stuff that will go on the front page of the Times, but it's incredibly exciting from a physics perspective. And then I would say you start with the real hunt for things like the Higgs particle or supersymmetry or extra dimensions or whatever when you've calibrated the detectors and when you understand them.
That's Manchester University and CERN scientist Brian Cox discussing the work that's going on at the LHC in Geneva. I was tempted to suggest to Brian that things can only get better, but I wasn't sure he'd actually appreciate the joke. And just in case you don't, in fact, Brian used to be the keyboard player of the band D-Ream. Well, that's almost it for this month. We'd better find out the answer to our chemical conundrum, though, Richard.
Well, we asked, what is the name of the only scientist ever to have won two Nobel Prizes for chemistry, and what protein would you associate him with?
And the answer, of course, is Fred Sanger and insulin, which he very famously sequenced, which got him his first Nobel Prize. And the winners this month, of the first out the hat, are Mickey Davis, Jason Hui, and Yadhunath Kanmani. And I apologise if I've mispronounced anybody's name there.
Fantastic, and well done all of you. So, Rich, what do you want people to try and answer for you next month?
Well, with this year's Nobel Prize being awarded for a glowing protein, our question this month is asking about another glowing molecule, not from jellyfish, though, but from wintergreen lifesavers. And for all you UK listeners out there, that's the American version of our Polo mints. If you crunch them in your mouth, you'll see a faint blue-green spark coming out. We want to know, what is the chemical in these sweets that emits that light as you chew them? Send your answers to chemistryworld@rsc.org. Please give us your name and your address as well so we can send you your goodies. And in addition to the normal goodie bag, we're going to be giving you some wintergreen lifesavers as well so you can try that effect out for yourself.
A tasty prize indeed. Thank you, Richard. And you can also use that email address to send us your thoughts and feedback about this or one of our previous Chemistry World podcasts. Don't forget that we also produce a weekly podcast called Chemistry in Its Element, where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. And you can tune into Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes or via our website at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World was brought to you this month by Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden, and James Mitchell Crowe. Production was by Mira Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com, and I'm Chris Smith. Until next time, goodbye!
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.